Welcome. Let's resume our chapter. We're in the chapter Works and Sacrifice, roughly halfway through it. And let's pick up from the last sentence in the paragraph we ended with. It's about desireless work. Sri Aurobindo writes, "Be free from obscuration and bewilderment by the three gunas, and action can continue, as it must continue, and even the largest, richest, or most enormous and violent action. It does not matter, for nothing then touches the Purusha. The soul has naishkarmya," desireless work. And that was from the third chapter, you'll remember, in the fourth shloka, the fourth verse. The term naishkarmya, of course, obtains again in the 18th chapter in the phrase naishkarmya siddhim, desireless perfection. In fact, maybe I'll just read that rendering that Sri Aurobindo made of that in English. "An understanding without attachment in all things, a soul self-conquered and empty of desire, man attains by renunciation a supreme perfection of naishkarmya." It is the absence of ego and attachment that is the key to fulfillment in work. So Sri Aurobindo has adumbrated that at the close of this paragraph, and he goes on to write, "But at present," remember we're in the early section of the third chapter here, "but at present the Gita does not proceed to that larger point. Since the mind is the instrumental cause, since inaction is impossible, what is rational, necessary, the right way, is a controlled action of the subjective and objective organism. Yama, control, holding yourself and reining yourself in, ordaining your work, is key to the practice of yoga. We see this in the Mahabharata. We see it in the Yoga Sutras 1,000 years later, or several hundred years later anyway. To be able to govern oneself, to be able to restrain one's energies, movements out, titillations of the senses, seductions of the mind, whatever it might be, to be able to govern oneself and one's nature is necessary to the practice of yoga. It is essential." Sri Aurobindo continues, "The mind must bring the senses under its control as an instrument of the intelligent will, buddhi. And then the organs of action must be used for their proper office, for action, but for action done as yoga. For oneness, to reunite." And so the circling of the energy, since it's been deposited in our laps, now has to move back up as an offering back to that from which it came. "But what is..." Oh, by the way, before we go on, I should mention that we're at 3, Shloka 7, chapter 3, Shloka 7, with that But what is the essence of this self-control? What is meant by action done as yoga, karma yoga? It is non-attachment. It is to do works without clinging with the mind to the objects of sense and the fruit of the works. Not complete in action, which is an error, a confusion, a self-delusion, an impossibility, but action full and free, done without subjection to sense and passion, desireless and unattached works are the first secret of perfection. Do action, thus self-controlled, says Krishna. Niyatam kuru karma tvam. I have said that knowledge, the intelligence, is greater than works. Jayasi karmano buddhihi. But I did not mean that inaction is greater than action. The contrary is the truth. Karma jayo akarmana. So here we've gone from 3:8, niyatam kuru karma tvam, 3:8, to jayasi karmano buddhi, that's 3:1. And we're going back now to 3:8. For knowledge does not mean renunciation of works. It means equality and non-attachment to desire and the objects of sense. So being detached and being equal. It means equality and non-attachment to desire and the objects of sense. And it means the poise of the intelligent will in the soul, free and high uplifted above the lower instrumentation of prakriti, and controlling the works of the mind and the senses and body in the power of self-knowledge and the pure, objectless self-delight of spiritual realization. Niyatam karma. There's a footnote, but let's make sure that we understand what he means here, that we have to be poised above in the intelligent will to be able to practice this yoga of knowledge, which is capable of uniting us with the pure principle of karma yoga. And then we can get the fruit of both. I don't mean grabbing at the fruit of the action, but I mean the perfection that comes with the practice of yoga. So, niyatam karma means controlled action, literally. There's the footnote. Again, I cannot accept the current interpretation of niyatam karma as if it meant fixed and formal works and were equivalent to the Vedic nitya karma, the regular works of sacrifice, ceremonial, and the daily rule of Vedic living. So niyatam karma is not nitya karma. Nitya karma, from the times of the Vedas, meant how you basically governed your life, how you lived as you went through things, basically telling you how to eat, how to sleep, how to bathe, how to pray, how to earn your living. Those were the things that all good people did according to Vedic injunction. That's not what niyatam karma is, though. Sri Aurobindo continues, surely niyata simply takes up the niyamya of the last verse. Krishna makes a statement, quote, he who controlling the senses by the mind engages with the organs of action in yoga of action, he excels. manasa niyamya arabhate karma yogam. And he immediately goes on to draw from the statement an injunction to sum it up and convert it into a rule. Do thou do controlled action. Niyatam kuru karma tvam. Niyatam takes up the niyamya, kuru karma takes up the arabhate karma yogam. Not formal works fixed by an external rule, but desireless works controlled by the liberated buddhi, is the Gita's teaching. In other words, the poetic allusion, the turn of phrase that's made in Sanskrit, works to our favor when we understand where he's going, what the inner meaning is that Krishna is driving at. And he turns it into something fundamental. This is how you should do. Do controlled action. Govern your action. That's the first step on your path. And by the way, you also might want to look at, again, the 18th chapter, where Krishna is beginning to sum up the whole of the book, the whole of his teaching. So 18, 9, and 23. Have a look when you have a moment. But we're still up there where the footnote occurred. Buddhi Yoga, and here we're back to 3.7. Buddhi Yoga is fulfilled by Karma Yoga. So the yoga of knowledge is fulfilled by the yoga of works. Ta-da! They come together. We know best when we can do it. We only know it when we do it. The yoga of the self-liberating intelligent will finds its full meaning by the yoga of desireless works. Thus, the Gita founds its teaching of the necessity of desireless works, nishkama karma, and unites the subjective practice of the Sankhyas, rejecting their merely physical rule, with the practice of yoga. And it's true that the term nishkama karma does not occur exactly in the Gita, but we know what he means. Desireless work. Work without desire. You can recall back in chapter 2, shlokas 47 and 48. But still, there is an essential difficulty unsolved. Desire is the ordinary motive of all human actions. And if the soul is free from desire, then there is no farther rationale for action. We may be compelled to do certain works for the maintenance of the body, but even that is a subjection to the desire of the body, which we ought to get rid of if we are to attain perfection. But granting that this cannot be done, the only way is to fix a rule for action outside ourselves, not dictated by anything in our subjectivity, the nitya karma of the Vedic rule, the routine of ceremonial sacrifice, daily conduct, and social duty, which the man who seeks liberation may do simply because it is enjoined upon him, without any personal purpose or subjective interest in them, with an absolute indifference to the doing. Not because he is compelled by his nature, but because it is enjoined by the Shastra. We're going to live by the code. But if the principle of the action is not to be external to the nature, but subjective, if the actions even of the liberated and the sage are to be controlled and determined by his nature, swabhava niyatam, then the only subjective principle of action is desire of whatever kind, lust of the flesh or emotion of the heart or base or noble aim of the mind, but all subject to the gunas of prakriti. Again, have a look at 1847 if you want. Let us then interpret the Niyata Karma of the Gita as the Nitya Karma of the Vedic rule. It's Kartavya Karma, or work that has to be done, is the Aryan rule of social duty. And let us take, too, its work done as a sacrifice to mean simply these Vedic sacrifices and this fixed social duty performed disinterestedly and without any personal object. Don't be confused. This is not Sri Aurobindo's position. This is not the Gita's position. In fact, he says now, this is how the Gita's doctrine of desireless work is often interpreted. But it seems to me that the Gita's teaching is not so crude and simple, not so local and temporal and narrow as all that. It is large, free, subtle, and profound. It is for all time and for all men, not for a particular age and country. You may remember, those of you who have studied religion in the 20th century, that there was this idea in scholastic enterprises of how all teachings are rooted in the spatio-temporal. They're all stuck, eventually, in a place and a time. And that may be true, but you see the Gita working laboriously to free itself from the injunctions of the Veda, from the expectations of the crowd, from all the virtues that society holds high, and is breaking all of them to put you in a liberated state where you live freely from your spirit. And it's fact, because Krishna did such a beautiful job of that, that we can advance through the achievements that he attained himself upon earth. And Sri Aurobindo noted that he was, in a sense, the lord of the Anandamaya plane, as seen through the overmind. Huh? The principle of bliss itself expressed cosmically in a vast consciousness. Well, if he had not done that, if he had not brought that possibility to the earth, then we would still be wrestling to achieve it. Sri Aurobindo would not have been able to advance in his own yoga towards the supramental possibility. So thank goodness for this great and large and plastic teaching of the Gita. I think Sri Aurobindo is onto something here, and we need to see the Gita in its largest and deepest sense and not try to restrict it to its time and place. Third or fourth century BCE, fixed in India. It's a teaching for us all. Especially, if I've read this before, pardon me, I'm going to read the close of this paragraph entirely. But it seems to me that the Gita's teaching is not so crude and simple, not so local and temporal and narrow as all that. It is large, free, subtle, and profound. It is for all time and for all men, not for a particular age and country. Especially, it is always breaking free from external forms, details, dogmatic notions, and going back to principles and the great facts of our nature and our being. It is a work of large philosophic truth and spiritual practicality, not of constrained religious and philosophical formulas and stereotyped dogmas. The difficulty is this: how, our nature being what it is, and desire the common principle of its action, is it possible to institute a really desireless action? For what we call ordinarily disinterested action is not really desireless. It is simply a replacement of certain smaller personal interests by other larger desires which have only the appearance of being impersonal: virtue, country, mankind. All action, moreover, as Krishna insists, is done by the gunas of Prakriti, by our nature. in acting according to the Shastra, we are still acting according to our nature, even if this Shastric action is not, as it usually is, a mere cover for our desires, prejudices, passions, egoisms, our personal, national, sectarian vanities, sentiments, and preferences. But even otherwise, even at the purest, still we obey a choice of our nature. And if our nature were different and the gunas acted on our intelligence and will in some other combination, we would not accept the Shastra, but live according to our pleasure or our intellectual notions, or else break free from the social law to live the life of the solitary or the ascetic. Much of this is pinned to Chapter 3, Shloka 5, by the way. We cannot become impersonal by obeying something outside ourselves, for we cannot so get outside ourselves. We can only do it by rising to the highest in ourselves, into our free soul and self, which is the same and one in all, and has therefore no personal interests, to the divine in our being, who possesses himself, transcendent of cosmos, and is therefore not bound by his cosmic works or his individual action. That is what the Gita teaches. And desirelessness is only a means to this end, not an aim in itself. Yes, but how is it to be brought about? By doing all works with sacrifice as the only object, is the reply of the divine teacher. By doing works otherwise than for sacrifice, this world of men is in bondage to works. For sacrifice, practice works, O son of Kunti, becoming free from all attachment. Chapter 3, Shloka 9. Whatever you do, it must be an offering. Whatever you do is a sacrament, and whatever results from the action you undertake is offerable. Everything. The meanest actions, the most sublime actions. All unite you to that. Establish and reestablish your communion with that. It is evident, he writes, that all works and not merely sacrifice and social duties can be done in this spirit. Any action may be done either from the ego sense, narrow or enlarged, or for the sake of the divine. All being and all action of Prakriti exist only for the sake of the divine. From that it proceeds, by that it endures, to that it is directed. This reminds you of the Taittiriya Upanishad, remember? When the Father sends the Son, go find out what is that from which all things come, that in which all things is sustained, that in which all things pass, and they're going hence. And he finds level after level after level of wondrous reality, leading us all the way from the material form of things back to the bliss that is their original fount. We have this echoed in this very sentence from Sri Aurobindo here. But so long as we are dominated by the ego sense, we cannot perceive or act in the spirit of this truth, but act for the satisfaction of the ego and in the spirit of the ego, otherwise than for sacrifice. Egoism is the knot of the bondage. By acting Godwards without any thought of ego, we loosen this knot and finally arrive at freedom. So the very fact that we're offering what we do, the fruit of it, the very action of it, the very form of it, all of it, in a sense, floating above, as if aimed to that, begins to lift us out of our ego. Egoism begins to disappear. Eventually, ego follows in the path to disappearance, and the soul is left, your true individuality, which then reunites with the Supreme from which it came. And the circle is closed. We have harmony again. We have oneness again. At first, however, the Gita takes up the Vedic statement of the idea of sacrifice and phrases the law of sacrifice in its current terms. And this is chapter 3, shlokas 10 through 16. This it does with a definite object. We have seen that the quarrel between renunciation and works has two forms, the opposition of Sankhya and Yoga, which is already in principle reconciled, and the opposition of Vedism and Vedantism, which the teacher has yet to reconcile. The first is a larger statement of the opposition, in which the idea of works is general and wide. The Sankhya starts from the notion of the divine status as that of the immutable and inactive Purusha, which each soul is in reality, and makes an opposition between inactivity of Purusha and the activity of Prakriti. So its logical culmination is cessation of all works. Yoga starts from the notion of the divine as Ishvara, Lord of the operations of Prakriti, and therefore superior to them. And its logical culmination is not cessation of works, but the soul's superiority to them and freedom even though doing all works. In the opposition of Vedism and Vedantism, works, karma, are restricted to Vedic works and sometimes even to Vedic sacrifice and ritualized works, all else being excluded as not useful to salvation. Vedism of the Mimamsakas insisted on them, works, as the means. Vedantism, taking its stand on the Upanishads, looked on them as only a preliminary, belonging to the state of ignorance, and in the end, to be overpassed and rejected, an obstacle to the seeker of liberation. Vedism worshipped the devas, the gods, with sacrifice, and held them to be the powers who assist our salvation. Vedantism was inclined to regard them, the gods, as powers of the mental and material world opposed to our salvation. Men, says the Upanishad, are the cattle of the gods who do not desire man to know and be free. It saw the divine as the immutable Brahman who has to be attained, not by works of sacrifice and worship, but by knowledge. Works only lead to material results and to an inferior paradise. Therefore, they have to be renounced. So these antinomies. The Gita resolves this opposition by insisting that the devas are only forms of the one deva, the Ishvara, the Lord of all yoga and worship and sacrifice and austerity. And if it is true that sacrifice offered to the devas leads only to material results and to paradise, it is also true that sacrifice offered to the Ishvara leads beyond them, the gods, to the great liberation. For the Lord and the immutable Brahman are not two different beings, but one and the same being. And whoever strives towards either is striving towards that one divine existence. Now, just a quick note here. This is, of course, personally realized in the deep spiritual experience of Sri Ramakrishna in the 19th century and by Sri Aurobindo in the 20th. All works in their totality find their culmination and completeness in the knowledge of the divine. Sarvam karma kilam partha jnana, pardon me, jnane parisamapyate. That's chapter 4, shloka 33. They are not an obstacle, but the way to the supreme knowledge. Works lead you to the supreme knowledge. Thus, this opposition too is reconciled with the help of a large elucidation of the meaning of sacrifice. In fact, its conflict is only a restricted form of the larger opposition between yoga and Sankhya. Vedism is a specialized and narrow form of yoga. The principle of the Vedantists is identical with that of the Sankhyas, for to both, the movement of salvation is the recoil of the intelligence, the buddhi, from the differentiating powers of nature, from ego, mind, senses, from the subjective and the objective, and its return to the undifferentiated and the immutable. It is with this object of reconciliation in his mind that the teacher first approaches his statement of the doctrine of sacrifice. But throughout, even from the very beginning, he keeps his eye not on the restricted Vedic sense of sacrifice and works, but on their larger and universal application. That widening of narrow and formal notions to admit the great general truths they unduly restrict, which is always the method of the Gita. So we come to the end of this chapter, and we continue with the retitled 12th chapter, now known as The Significance of Sacrifice, next time we gather. I know that we're on the verge of the 4th of July, Day of Independence, Day of Liberty. For us who are aspirants in the integral yoga, it means one thing, of course, and that is the liberation of all of our nature into the freedom of the spirit and its perfection here through every element of this form. So if you'll permit me, I'll read a short passage from Savitri, Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, in Canto 6, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Life. I think I'm starting on page 189. Roughly halfway down. As if sitting near an open window's gap, he read by lightning flash on crowding flash chapters of her metaphysical romance, of the soul's search for lost reality, and her fictions, drawn from spirit's authentic fact, her caprices and conceits and meanings locked, her rash, unseizable freaks and mysteried turns. The magnificent wrappings of her secrecy that fold her desirable body out of sight, the strange, significant forms woven on her robe, her meaningful outlines of the souls of things he saw, her false transparencies of thought hue, her rich brocades with imaged fancies sewn, and mutable masks and broideries of disguise. 1,000 baffling faces of the truth looked at him from her forms with unknown eyes and wordless mouths, unrecognizable, spoke from the figures of her masquerade, or peered from the recondite magnificence and subtle splendor of her draperies. In sudden scintillations of the unknown, inexpressive sounds became veridical. Ideas that seemed unmeaning flashed out truth. Voices that came from unseen waiting worlds uttered the syllables of the unmanifest to clothe the body of the mystic word, and wizard diagrams of the occult law sealed some precise, unreadable harmony, or used hue and figure to reconstitute the herald blazon of time's secret things. In her green wildernesses and lurking depths, in her thickets of joy, where danger clasps delight, he glimpsed the hidden wings of her songster hopes, a glimmer of blue and gold and scarlet fire. In her covert lanes, bordering her chance field paths, and by her singing rivulets and calm lakes, he found the glow of her golden fruits of bliss and the beauty of her flowers of dream and muse. As if a miracle of hearts changed by joy, he watched in the alchemist radiance of her suns the crimson outburst of one secular flower on the tree of sacrifice of spiritual love. In the sleepy splendor of her noons he saw, a perpetual repetition through the hours, thoughts dance of dragonflies on mystery's stream, that skim but never test its murmurs race, and heard the laughter of her rose desires, running as if to escape from longed-for hands, jingling sweet anklet bells of fantasy. Amidst live symbols of her occult power, he moved and felt them as close real forms. In that life, more concrete than the lives of men, throbbed heartbeats of the hidden reality. Embodied was there what we both think and feel. Self-framed, what here takes outward borrowed shapes. A comrade of silence on her austere heights, accepted by her mighty loneliness, he stood with her on meditating peaks, where life and being are a sacrament offered to the reality beyond, and saw her loose into infinity, her hooded eagles of significance, messengers of thought through the unknowable. Identified in soul vision and soul sense, entering into her depths as into a house, all he became that she was or longed to be. He thought with her thoughts and journeyed with her steps, lived with her breath and scanned all with her eyes, that so he might learn the secret of her soul. A witness overmastered by his scene, he admired her splendid front of pomp and play, and the marvels of her rich and delicate craft, and thrilled to the insistence of her cry. Impassioned, he bore the sorceries of her might, felt laid on him her abrupt, mysterious will, her hands that need fate in their violent grasp, her touch that moves, her powers that seize and drive. But this too he saw, her soul that wept within, her seeking's vain that clutch at fleeing truth, her hopes whose somber gaze mates with despair, the passion that possessed her longing limbs, the trouble and rapture of her yearning breasts, her mind that toils unsatisfied with its fruits, her heart that captures not the one beloved. Always he met a veiled and seeking force, an exiled goddess building mimic heavens, a sphinx whose eyes look up to a hidden sun. Well, look you up into the full radiance of the sun. Be satisfied with nothing less. Looking at you, I'm given hope. Thank you for being with me. Much love from here in Pensacola. We're lonely without you. Stay well. Come see us soon. Inwardly, at the very least. Much love. Namaste. Jai Ma.